So if you take a rich developing country, the theory went, then they should be able to buy the resources they need, the physical resources, and also buy the technicians and the people to help train their own people, and you know, it just should be a matter of time before this country should prosper. Well, the way it worked out in Iran was that I think the wealth that they had really caused many of the more problems than it solved, because the Shah kept thinking, first I have all the money to do everything, you know, money's no object, we can do anything we want, let's just get on with all these projects. So they just threw money at everything. And they, you know, every ministry wanted a computer, and every ministry wanted technical advisors from the West, and every ministry wanted a whole list of projects. And everybody tried to do everything at once. There was really no one setting priorities. I mean, you know, they did the census by computers. 19, I forget now which census. Wouldn't have been on the same schedule as ours, but as I recall, there was a census done while I was there that second time. And they processed all the data on IBM computers and so on. Iran Air just burgeoned as a great international carrier, you know, buying 747s and 707s all over the place. And I mean, there was no area that there wasn't some bold new program underway. And so the number of people who could really manage things effectively was stretched very thin. Mm-hmm. And because the Shah had never allowed anybody to have any independence, and never allowed any institutions to build up any kind of real core of trained people, that they could, where they could really run things, the expertise was very shallow in every ministry, in every activity that was going on doing things. Even with the money that they had from oil, they were having trouble meeting all their bills, and there were always American companies coming around the embassy saying, please help us get paid, because we've done this and so on a contract, and they'd show us all the contracts, but we're still not being paid. And then we'd go to the appropriate ministry, and they'd say, well, we certainly intend to pay that bill, we know the work's been done, but we have to send the papers through the Ministry of Finance. There was just constantly people coming in and complaining that they couldn't get paid. So some firms finally began to only do things subject to advance payment. They would say, no, under this contract we'll do this and so, and the advance payment required is this amount. And if we get that, then we'll do that work. If not, we can't. So I would say that was the main thing I imparted to visitors who came and wanted to know what was going on in the country, that economically it was pursuing too many goals all at once. Politically, it was stable in the sense that the Shah had been in power for all these years and was surely paramount in authority in the country, but his ability to run the entire country was affected by the quality of people he had working for him. And he couldn't have a handful of very good people that he had running everything, so he had to depend on people way out at the lower levels getting things done, and they just didn't do it. In fact, the fact that they had all kinds of money meant oftentimes that the Iranians themselves became sort of lazy and felt that they should bring in foreigners. And so they brought in Koreans to drive trucks, and they brought in Japanese to build refineries, and they brought in Turks, and they brought in Pakistanis, they brought in Indians. I mean, you know, and we could see this, you know, even our everyday life. We could see that there were so many foreigners coming into the country to do all kinds of jobs, which the Iranians began to consider sort of menial jobs. You know, and they were going to, and the Shah's publicity and propaganda sort of fed on them on this, that we have all this money and we're going to be the equal of France or England, and so, you know, we can now propose and dispose. We don't need to really work all that hard because we've got all this money, this oil money flowing in, and we'll be able to buy all the services we need. It was a Klondike mentality. And prices were shooting up, and everybody was buying cars and trying to have the latest hi-fi. It was a, you know, just a, at least in Tehran, there was this total devotion to consumerism and material wealth. And a lot of Iranians complained about this constantly. I mean, they bemoaned the passing of the good old days when people had time to talk and visit and so on. Everybody's now making money, everybody's rushing around, the traffic is horrible. Quality of life in Tehran had deteriorated markedly from earlier years when I was there. Smog was terrible. This whole pallor over the city. You couldn't even see the Elbrus Mountains anymore. I mean, that's how bad the pollution was. When I was there earlier, and even as a boy, and the mountains were so dramatic with the snow on them most of the year that and they were just constantly there in the north. They just glanced up and here were these beautiful mountains. Well, by the mid-70s, you couldn't see the mountains because maybe just a vague outline through the haze. And people, you know, they all began to, I think, in their own minds, question the value of what was going on. Running faster and faster, pollution and traffic and just general quality of life going down. They liked Western ways. They wore college t-shirts. You saw Harvard, Princeton, Yale, whatever, t-shirts all over the place. They loved American music, so on and so on. But a lot of older people began to question, and some of the young began to question too, what are we going to become? And the Shah talked about the great civilization as if it was, you know, taking the best from the West and leaving behind what we don't want and creating our own synthesis of the best of our own Iranian background and the West. But that was just hyperbole because, as the everyday Iranian saw, there were Americans, Germans, Dutch, French, everybody running around doing everything under contract to the government, making lots of money. And the Iranians felt that they were losing their soul at the time when they were gaining more prosperity. And even the prosperity was, you know, concentrated in the hands of those who were benefiting from this tremendous rush of development. And the poor people were not sharing it, particularly in the cities. There was some trickle-down effect in the rural areas, but then as the Shah began to put more and more money into buying food for consumption. I mean, he bought wheat, rice, frozen lamb, eggs. While I was there in the 70s, there was even a full 707 plane load of eggs from Romania. One whole plane full of eggs that arrived. And thousands of tons of lamb were being brought in from New Zealand and Australia. In 1 year, they purchased over $1 billion of food from the U.S. alone. Rice, wheat, soybeans. I mean, you know, it was a bonanza of money that was available. So one of the ideas was to bring in these items and keep the prices low so that the population will be able to buy food cheaply. Well, that was fine, but the people who produced rice up in the Caspian Sea coast, they couldn't bring the rice to Tehran to compete with the price that the Shah was bringing rice in from the United States and making it available through government-supported stores at a low price so that the poor farmers couldn't even sell their crops at a profit. So then they were just giving up and migrating to Tehran. There were hundreds of thousands of people who moved from the provinces into Tehran during this period.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned a few minutes ago that you said that despite the growing wealth, you told people, I guess in your briefings, that the situation wasn't really that stable in some respects. How much concern was there at the embassy about elements of instability and their political implications? Or was it assumed that the situation was basically stable?
Well, I think a lot of people realized that there was this lack of institutions that I mentioned,
yeah.
That so much depended on the Shah and his close advisors for final decision, that the situation in political dynamics terms was unstable, but the rejoinder to that was always, well, sure, but what's new? You know, in that sense, in a very political science sense, the country had been unstable for a long time because of this way of governing, but why worry about it? Because, I mean, how can you predict when it's going to fall apart? Are there signs that it's that the Shah's losing his grip? Are there signs that the country is falling apart? No. Because, I mean, there was this, still this frenzy of development going on. And at that time, as late as, you know, 76, the only signs of real danger, I would say, were the assassinations that the Mujahideen and the Mujahideen and Khalq, you know, there were the two groups, and they really went after some of the Shah's officials, assassinating some in broad daylight, and they killed a couple of American colonels while I was there. There were these activities that clearly showed a lot of organized activity under the scenes, where people were unhappy enough to take matters in their own hands. There were other signs. There were signs of increasing concern on college campuses with religion. Despite all the effort made to convince women that they had equal rights with men, you began to see more chadors being worn, you know, the tent-like covering their students, you know, young girls who are voluntarily wearing chadors on campus, where you would think that would be the sort of, you know, the prime area for people to not go in for these signs of the past. But there was this sort of feeling that Sodom and Gomorrah is here, and we've got to return to religion. And so there's a sort of a conservative development taking place, and we were aware of that. We saw some of these signs, but when I left in 76, there were still just these vague rumblings of discontent, and there were these specific staccato activities of assassination and so on, but nothing really destabilizing in the overall picture. So yes, it was unstable, but it wasn't clearly unstable in ways you could put your finger on or say, well, you know, because of this, the Shah's not going to be around in 3 years or whatever. It wasn't that clear a call to make. What I kept saying was that we must not put the Shah on a pedestal. We must report things as they are, and we must not say too many things that just gild the lily. You know, to talk about the white revolution as if it were accomplished, and, you know, this great leader has accomplished the white revolution, is not correct. That's why in that report I just mentioned that I put down in the summary and at the end that this is unfinished business. You know, it's something in process. I particularly focused on the development of the Rastafiz Party. When the Shah proclaimed the Rastafiz Party, I wrote a very critical analysis in a telegram and got it cleared through, perhaps in part because Jack Miklos was on leave, but anyway, I got this cleared and got it out. The ambassador signed off on it, and it basically said that the Shah is really mismanaging this whole activity. He had in the past created, as you know, various political parties. At one time it was the Meryun and the Mardom, which were sort of tame but opposition parties to give people a choice. Then later there was the Iran Noveen Party, which was a sort of a modernizing force for those who wanted to get into the power game. But that was, you know, you had a choice there. But suddenly the Rastafiz Party came along, the Resurgence Party, and everybody had to join. And if you didn't join, you just had no future in the country. You might as well leave, because you just had to become a member. And I made the point that if something is so all-inclusive, everybody has to be a member, then it has no value, because with that large membership, it's got to be run by a smaller group. And the whole idea of the party as a sort of a rubber stamp for what the Shah wants to do for the country was, I think, a very basic misreading of his own country. And I think his misguided effort showed that he had this megalomaniac complex that was beginning to assert itself. He took the rest of his party, along with his declarations about this great society or this great civilization that he was heading, and that the country was going to be the equivalent of France and England in a few more years, plus all the things they were going to do that would put them on the footing with every advanced country, all these developments that I mentioned. I mean, it's just too much. He just tried to do more things than his country or he were able to accomplish.
Mm-hmm. Now, last time you mentioned that I think Ambassador Helms did not take up your proposal to develop contacts with some of the oppositional clergy, clerics. How much work did the embassy political officers do on actually observing or analyzing the opposition to the Shah during this period? Or for that matter, keeping contacts with any opposition figures? Was there any effort made in that direction?
Oh, definitely, yeah. Maintained our contacts with the opposition. We tried to find out just what their ideas were and how far they felt they could go in organizing, which was basically that everyone could talk and have contacts with other people, but as long as you didn't do anything to actually implement any of your plans. I mean, you know, the people talk about Iran as a police state. I never bought that as a concept. I told people it was a police state, but an inefficient one. That Savak could never keep track of all the people's views as Iranians would tell you them, and they would say, "Can't talk about this because Savak may be listening." But in fact, the average Iranian was very free to talk about his ideas, and that's. They did that constantly. I mean, hours every day they spent talking with each other about their thoughts and who was doing what and the latest developments and what they signified. The Dore system was an institutionalized way of finding out what was going on through having contacts with people who would tell you but who could not write anything down or could not do anything in sort of an organizational sense. So there was a great deal of discussion of political events all the time, and people quite free to express their opinions as long as it was in a small group where they knew people. So that, in that sense, people were quite free to talk, but they weren't free to do anything. They weren't free to take any action. They weren't free to go out and demonstrate. That was the sort of dividing line. And when they did demonstrate, they knew that they were likely to be put in jail or whatever.
My impression is that there was some very deep-seated opposition to the Shah existing in the bazaar of Tehran and elsewhere, the old middle classes, which was closely linked to the clerical establishment. How much effort was made on how much effort was taken to understand those social forces or political forces, the people in the bazaar? To keep contact with those social groupings.
I would say we tried to keep contact with them. We knew some bazaar merchants. I lived across the street from a family who had several stores in the bazaar, and I visited their shop in the bazaar. Other Americans spent time in the bazaar, not just for their own purposes, but to more or less learn about how things went there. But the link between the clergy and the merchants was very difficult to fathom. I mean, you knew it was there, but for an outsider, a Westerner, to try and find out how it worked was very difficult. Mati Daftari was one who knew that milieu. He was a lawyer, but he also we had enough contacts to know how that link established. So we tried to keep up with some of these kind of people as to what was happening. We knew that the Shah's campaign against price gouging was having a bad effect on the bazaar, because he thought of this as a very popular campaign, you know, that would brand a few merchants as profiteers, and he had these price investigation squads going around who could price certain things and then really pillory a particular merchant for having sold some items at a higher cost. But it was a sort of hit or miss kind of thing, which was very inefficiently done and unfairly done. And the bazaar resented it deeply, because they felt the Shah was ruining the economy of the country by all this purchase from outside the country in order to maintain low prices for food and other things, and that the legitimate merchants were being squeezed out because the government was competing with them in one way by bringing in all these things at low prices and distributing through government stores to keep people happy, and yet the bazaar merchants were hurt, because if you bought a BMW, of course you bought it from a big dealer uptown, and you know, a lot of the prestige purchasing and purchasing of luxury items is all in northern Tehran, and the people in the bazaar who sold just everyday items for the people, they began to suffer. Because there was this pulling away, there was the rich group was buying more and more luxury items, and the poor people were without enough funds to pay even for some of the necessities that they needed. So the bazaar merchants were caught in the middle. The trade was moving north for the rich and deteriorating for the poor, particularly because, as I mentioned, a lot of these landless people who'd left their farms came into the city and they couldn't find work, and they just roamed around, and it was a, you know, very divisive force. They lived in little bidonvilles, these little shacks all, I mean, bidonville is what the French call it, but, you know, these little shacks by the thousands in South Tehran, and on the outskirts of Tehran, you'd see block after block of these just makeshift huts that people built with pieces of tin, anything they could find that would shield them from the weather. They made these little houses, and they just lived there. Some of them had part-time income from selling lottery tickets or whatever little make-work project they could find, but basically they were just urban squatters who had little or no employment, and they were a very fertile ground for Khomeini to plow, which he did consistently during this time by sending in cassette tapes, which would be played in some of the mosques on Friday, or played by in groups where people could congregate around in someone's house and listen to the tape. It was really a potent force, and these are the people who really were not touched by the White Revolution, you see, because the White Revolution, as I make the point in that aerogram there, it really benefited the rural areas first. So many of the programs were, you know, keyed to the rural areas. And, I mean, even the health corps was to take health to the villages, but how about the poor guy in South Tehran who couldn't afford a doctor? Yeah. I mean, you know, he was caught in the middle. He didn't get government help, but he had no money with which to pay a doctor either, so he just had to go to a pharmacy and try to afford something that in the way of medicine that he needed. So the urban lower class were really forgotten in this whole thing. They, except for the subsidized food, nothing was done for them. Mm-hmm. And they were intensely dissatisfied.
Mm-hmm. One more question about this issue of the contacts of the oppositional figures. You said you had some you and other political officers had some contacts with opposition figures, but you also said that there were some constraints. That you were, for example, you were discouraged from pursuing contacts with some of the religious figures when you brought it up at the embassy meeting. Were there any other examples of efforts to discourage such contacts by you, discourage you or other political officers?
There weren't. Yeah. I felt quite free to develop additional contacts, whether they were opposition or not, and I did, but looking back on it, I would have to be self-critical and say I didn't do enough. But again, as I mentioned, the decline in resources meant that we all had to do so much more and cover so much more territory that you ran out of time, unless you really wanted to, totally end your own amusements and doing things with your family. You know, if you just spent full time working, you could have done more. But anyway, it's a difficult thing to say. I to some extent there was a feeling of self censorship, but I think that's overdone in Jim Bill's book. I don't think that there was that much actual limitation, or even perceived or imposed on us, as to who we could talk with. It's just that you didn't have enough time, and you wanted to develop contacts. You met other people, but you just didn't have the time to follow up with them and really go on from one to the next, which you should in that society. I mean, that's how you meet people. You go from one to the other. You never meet people cold. You never meet them as in an institution. You got to meet them through a friend. A friend of a friend of a friend, and you go on through this chain. It takes a lot of time to drink a lot of tea and take a lot of wasted trips to go see people who then turn out to be, you know, totally worthless and so on. But then they may lead you to somebody else who may be quite valuable. But it just takes an awful lot of time.
Now, besides the question of self-censorship, he mentions, he suggests that there are times on tables that when reports or cables were very critical, that included information that was very critical of the regime, were sometimes suppressed or not sent to Washington or accumulated in some censored cable file. Mm-hmm. Are there examples of that come to mind from your stay in Tehran in the 70s, of cables that were actually suppressed?
Or, not really in the 70s. I did argue a number of occasions on specific things, but you know, a lot of times there were nuances about, you know, what adjective to use here, or what word to use there, as to whether it's too strong or not strong enough. But I don't recall any, you know, real Donnybrooks over what we felt versus what was allowed out of the embassy. I did mention in that one report on the Rastafis that it was easier to get it out because Miklos was away. I would often have to argue some of my points with Jack to get them through him and to the ambassador. The ambassador was generally more willing to send things in as long as they were grounded in facts and so on. He was more willing to put that on the record and send it in than Miklos was. So that's another reason why I feel that Helms really did quite a good job there.
Mm-hmm. Okay. During the 60s and 70s, there were two influential social and political critics, Iranian critics of the society, were Jalal Ali Ahmad and Ali Shariati. How much do you know about these writers? I guess Shariati sort of wrote a synthesis of Islamic and Western thought that sort of, he used that as a way to criticize the Shah's regime.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess Ali Ahmad wrote a criticism of the influence of Western culture on Iranian society. He wrote a book called Garbzadegi.
Garbzadegi,
which is, I guess, translated West-struckness or West toxication.
Yeah, something like that, right.
How much did you know about those writers at the time you were stationed in Iran? I guess even the 60s or the 70s? Were they...
Well, one of the contacts that I found most useful along this line was Mrs. Ziai, that I mentioned earlier, the one who ran the student center. Mm-hmm. Because she kept abreast of a lot of developments on the scene, including sort of clandestine writers, you know, mm-hmm. people whose works were not available yeah. generally, but whose books circulated very rapidly underground, mm-hmm. and they did have quite a tradition of something like they have in Russia, you know, of a self-publishing and self-circulating situation, with, like they call samizdat in Russia. And she would tell us about some of these writers and what they thought, and showed how they were very cleverly using analogies from the past, or using poetry to get across points. They wouldn't make it, you know, a direct confrontation with the government, but they would use historical allegories, which the people clearly interpreted as being anti-government. And she would mention these and indicate how these showed a lot of the current trends. And we've discussed these yeah. these writers with her and others, and even, you know, got some examples of it. I mean, she showed us some examples. And so this was part of our overall mix of understanding the society. Mm-hmm. The development I mentioned about the resurgence of religious feeling and fervor on college campuses. A lot of these things we were well aware of through people like Mrs. Z.I. But you know, it's I mean, it's difficult to go back and say, well, yes, Mr. Chariot, he warned us about these things at that time. Everyone should have seen that this was going to happen. You know, there were so many people who wrote stories about Iran. Sadek Hidayat, the famous writer from even earlier times about Iran. And there was who was the guy? I forget the name of the man who wrote the book, The Identity Card.
I've heard of that, but I'm not sure. Yeah.
Maybe that. No, that wasn't Sadek Hidayat. That was another writer, I think. I haven't thought about it for a long time, but there was a book came out somewhere in this period called Identity Card, mm-hmm. you know, about a guy who lost his identity card and he had to go around and get a new one. And it was all about, you know, sort of the heavy hand of government, that you couldn't do anything unless you had this piece of paper that mm-hmm. Proved who you were. And, you know, he played on that theme that we all know who we are, but the government will deny everything to you unless you have that one little piece of paper. And, you know, there are a lot of criticisms of Iranian society and Iranian government during this period, not just these ones you mentioned, but a whole... Yeah. And they circulated so widely because people had money now and they had time. Well, they didn't, not a lot of time, but they gave time to things like that because it was part of the do-re system. I mean, you'd meet with certain friends and the topics of discussion ranged over these kinds of books and stories people were reading, and have you read this, and here's a copy. And some of these books that were forbidden by the government were just mm-hmm. flowing through the society like wildfire. I mean, you know, people would read them in two or three days and they'd pass it to a friend, and have you read so-and-so? Well, let's pass that along. So there was a tremendous interest in all kinds of writing, and it was hard for the government to keep up with it because, as I say, a lot of it was so cleverly done. It was allegorical, it was not directly stated, so you couldn't really pick out a word or even a few phrases and say that's anti-government, but the whole tone of it was so cleverly done that these things just permeated the society in that time.
Now, one point that James Bell makes in his book is that for the most part, American officials in Iran tend to be rather isolated, and that many embassy people did not have regular contacts with Iranians, and this relative isolation tended to limit their understanding of the country. Is it possible to generalize about this? I mean, how true was that of embassy officials in the mid-70s in your second stay there? This question of how true is this question of isolation? Or how?
Well, I think you could best answer that by going from the top down.
Yeah.
The ambassador, of course, had his residence right on the compound, a very lovely building in which he could entertain, and you know, that was appropriately representational. It was a beautiful residence with a lot of Persian architectural features built into it and so on, but that was strictly on the compound. Then the DCM's residence was also on the compound, but further back from the street.
Mm-hmm.
So those two were totally isolated in that sense. Counselors had, of course, large homes, and typically these, of course, all Iranian homes have gardens that are walled in from the street, so in a sense they're all exclusive.
Yeah.
There are no open lawns or whatever like in the United States. Everybody has a, even if it's a tiny little yard, it's fenced in with, mm-hmm. or walled in with a
mm-hmm.
high wall, maybe with glass shards set into the top of it to keep out thieves and whatever. So that's just standard. Even your, you know, very low middle class person, if he has a tiny little yard, you have it walled in. So, but anyway, so your counselors would have big houses, and they would get to know probably their neighbors, who also would probably be fairly wealthy people. Then you go down from that, people who had a little less money in the way of housing allowance would go to more modest housing.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time I was number two in the political section. I had a house with a small swimming pool and a small yard, and I got to know my neighbors. I knew two or three families, right? And I knew the Bazaar family right across the street. I knew their sons. I went down to the Bazaar for tours to them, to their store and so on. And my son went with them to visit the boys, to have Persian soup at a place one time. And, you know, we would take occasional walks or talk with them. And there was a government official down the street I got to know, and we exchanged visits and, you know, talked occasionally about political developments or civil service type questions and how the Iranian government functioned and so on. But of course, again, it made a difference. If you spoke Farsi, you could interact with your neighbors. If you didn't, you just got to know those who spoke some English, or maybe even got to know those who spoke little English, but it was all sort of superficial. I mean, you know, maybe meeting for tea or something and smiling and talking about children. I mean, it was very limited, some of the social interchange, particularly with the wives, because the Iranian women generally had no social concerns at all that it would overlap with a Westerner. I mean, and if they spoke any English at all, you'd get through a few questions about how many children do you have, and you know, where do you live, and then this conversation just sort of died.
Yeah.
So it was very hard to maintain it. Clearly, there was a distinction. I mean, Bill makes a big point about the commissary at the edge of the embassy compound, and it's true. I always sort of cringed at the thought of that as I went there, because you walk out with all these bags of groceries and put them in your car, and there were Iranians around watching, just, you know, a few bystanders, and you always felt that these were the Iranians watching the rich Americans buy their food and go off home. A lot of things did, as he says, percolate out of the commissary through various black market arrangements and so on, which the American military did their best to ferret out, and, you know, they sent some people back home and they caught them and so on, but there were still incidents of that. Sometimes even porters and so on would manage to lose a case of whiskey or whatever when the stuff was being moved into the back of the compounder. But again, you can overdo that, because, you know, Tehran was a very rich city in those days. I mean, I felt sometimes that we Americans were living in a lower standard of living than most of the Iranians that we were in touch with. Because, gosh, the amount of money that was in that city at that time was just incredible. I mentioned the Klondike mentality. People were buying BMWs, and they had two or three cars, and they were making trips all over the place, and those who'd been to Europe so many times that they got tired of it would then start going off to Brazil or India or some, you know, some new destination so they could brag to their friends that there were no rules this year. I went to Brazil. You know, I didn't just go to France or all those places you've all been, but I went to Brazil. And, you know, that kind of thing. I mean, there was an awful lot of conspicuous consumption. So it isn't fair, really, to say that we lived, you know, like kings and all the Iranians lived like peasants. That's certainly not true. Hmm. Tehran is a very rich city as you go north. Now, admittedly, there were very few Americans who lived, and Jim Bill is right about that, very few lived south of Takht-i Jamshid Avenue. There were some, and you know, occasional people who revolted against the general norm and particularly sought out places further toward the south of the city, but relatively few. But in that area where the embassy is and north of it, you know, there were just tens of thousands of very, very rich Iranians living very comfortable lives, and Americans were just really given a chance to keep up a similar standard of living by the fact that we could buy these things at the commissary and so on. Prices were high on the local market if you bought imported goods or, you know, particular foods. Americans, I think, generally took to Iranian food, and you know, a lot of you went to places and you did have Iranian style meals, so it was not totally different in that respect either. Certainly there was a tremendous difference between the way Americans and Iranians in the northern part of the city lived and those in the south. That's the real difference. Mm-hmm. But not between Americans and Iranians and other foreigners. In fact, the other diplomatic missions were far more profligate in the use of money than we were. Because I compare notes with them. I've compared notes with British and Swedish and Dutch and other diplomatic missions, and gosh, we would pay no more than X amount for a certain size house, and some of them would pay 10, 15, 20% more than that. It was a sort of a bidding war to get kind of places that you needed, because the city, as it saw this tremendous influx of money, was way behind on building houses and office buildings and so on, so that there was a bidding up of prices on everything, including real estate. And so there was a lot of competition among the various missions and among the companies that were there. It got so the companies were so tired of not being able to find rooms in the hotels. The hotels had occupancy rates of something like 98% or something, because all these foreigners streaming in for business contacts and so on, that some of them took to renting apartments, which they just kept. And then when they had their people come in on a trip, they put them in that apartment. Hmm. So they wouldn't have to worry about trying to get a hotel room. Hmm.
I have another question about Americans in Iran. To what extent, if ever, did ethnocentric attitudes crop up among Arabic diplomats or officials who were stationed in the country?
Oh, I think that it happened quite frequently. People that I met generally were very careful about what they said around Iranians, but when they would get together in just small groups of Westerners, there were some pejorative comments about various aspects of Iranian society. I mean, it just seems to be endemic in most any place you go. But I think most people were quite proper about that in any context where Iranians would overhear. I'm talking about people that I met in Tehran, both business, government, Ford Foundation, whatever. That does not hold true for the people I mentioned, the Bell Helicopter and some of the other companies,
people,
in the outlying areas where they tended to bring in a large number of people. A lot of them just, they would openly talk about the Farsis. Farsis are doing this and so, and you know, just not even understanding proper words to use for the country. I mean, Farsi is the language, and a Farsi could be a person from that, from Fars province, but to call all the people of the country Farsis was totally wrong. Yeah. Some of our American military fell into some of these patterns too, and you know, I think they also tended to get around the bar and, you know, make critical comments about all the things that